Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kevin Martin of Peace Action, who takes a critical look at President Trump's revised travel ban that targets travelers and refugees from six majority Muslim nations. James S. Henry, a longtime investigator of corrupt international banking and illegal tax havens, who discusses the connections he's uncovered between Donald Trump, a Russian oligarch, the Bank of Cyprus, and newly confirmed Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, and Linda Anderson, director of the group Bold Nebraska, who talks about continuing opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline after the Trump administration announced it is seeking to revive the project. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
More than 25 years after the Berlin Wall fell, Russia is pushing back against perceived aggression from the United States and European powers. The resistance surged in 2014 with Moscow's annexation of Crimea and engagement in the civil conflict in eastern Ukraine. Under President Vladimir Putin, Russia has increased its clout in the Middle East and Latin America, far beyond the borders of the states of the former Soviet Union. Andrei Klimov, a member of Russia's upper house of parliament, declared Russia is not some regional dwarf, but a world power with its own zone of influence. Russia's clout is clearly felt in Syria, where Putin has backed Moscow's old ally, Syrian strongman Bashar al-Assad, who faces continuing rebellion from foes, including militias backed by the U.S. Putin used his nation's military might to oust rebels during the siege of Aleppo. Russia's interest in the outcome of the war in Syria is linked with its long-term leases at the Syrian port of Tartus and the airbase at Latakia, which gives Moscow strategic launch points for future military operations in the Middle East. A resolution before the UN Security Council on February 28th would have imposed sanctions against Syrian officials involved in dropping chlorine-filled barrel bombs against opposition forces. However, the sanctions initiative, backed by the Trump administration, France, and England, failed when it was vetoed by both Russia and China. In a major win for immigrant rights advocates, Houston's Sheriff Ed Gonzalez dropped out of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement 287G program, which deputizes local police to act as immigration officers. In January, President Trump signed an executive order that included measures to expand the 287G program. Gonzalez, a Democrat, will reassign 10 sheriff's deputies who are responsible for assessing the immigration status of jailed suspects and holding them for deportation. During last fall's election campaign for Harris County Sheriff, Gonzalez called ICE's 287G program a violation of due process rights that leads to racial profiling, the separation of families, and mistrust of deputies. Under 287G, databases are checked for immigration status on minor infractions such as traffic violations. According to the Guardian newspaper, only 37 police departments in 16 states are currently participating in the 287G program. With 4 million residents in Greater Houston, Harris County was the most populous major city enrolled in the program before Sheriff Gonzalez severed ties with ICE. Maine state legislators have attempted five times to expand Medicaid under Obamacare, formerly known as the Affordable Care Act. However, each time Tea Party Governor Paul LePage has vetoed the bill, the legislature could not muster enough votes to override the veto. To bypass LePage's opposition, a new statewide coalition called Mainers for Healthcare is campaigning for a statewide ballot question to expand Medicaid coverage. If approved by voters, Maine would be required to accept federal dollars to expand healthcare coverage for the state's poor. Thus far, the coalition has collected over 60,000 signatures, more than enough to put the measure on this year's ballot. Yet it could be blocked if Republicans in Congress quickly repeal Obamacare. Maine is one of the poorest states in the nation. Under Medicaid expansion, 70,000 Mainers would gain access to health care, where it's estimated that 3,000 new health care jobs would be created. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
President Trump issued a revised travel ban on March 6th, more than a month after his initial January 27th executive order, provoked massive protests at airports from coast to coast. What many labeled as Trump's Muslim ban suspended entry of all refugees to the United States for 120 days and prohibited travel from seven Muslim-majority nations for 90 days. The order also blocked all refugees from Syria indefinitely and reduced the total number of refugees admitted into the U.S. during the 2017 fiscal year to 50,000, down from the previous cap of 110,000. In response to the filing of lawsuits, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit blocked key provisions of that travel ban based on likely violations of the U.S. Constitution. The new order, which takes effect on March 16th, maintains a 90-day ban on travel to the U.S. by citizens of six of the seven original nations targeted, dropping Iraq. Travelers from Iran, Libya, Syria, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen are affected, but the new ban exempts citizens from these countries who are legal U.S. permanent residents or have valid visas to enter the U.S., including those whose visas were revoked during the original implementation of the ban. Many immigration advocates said that Trump's revised ban still discriminated against Muslims and failed to address some concerns with the previous order. Joanne Lynn, the ACLU's senior legislative counsel, pledged that the group will pursue all legal remedies through the courts and elsewhere to make sure the new executive order won't go into effect on March 16th. Your reporter spoke with Kevin Martin, president of the group Peace Action, who takes a critical look at Trump's revised travel ban, explaining why he believes the measure makes the country less safe.
Well, I think they're playing a game of political chicken here. I guess I'll start with that first, because to me, I think that's more important than the substance. It was somewhat tweaked to possibly address some of the legal concerns, but also some of the protest and the backlash. And in that regard, people who have been resisting this awful travel ban, Muslim ban, you know, should feel somewhat good that the administration was forced to back off a little bit. But my sense is they're playing political chicken in that they tweaked it enough so they can claim it's different and say that they are trying to address the problems. And of course, they would never admit this, but they rushed it forward before, and it was a naked Muslim ban, and that was what they were trying to fulfill, a campaign promise. I think they are banking on the courts having such deference to the presidency, to the executive branch, that they will let this slide, that the courts will not once again try to strike it down. That's just my guess. That's just speculation. But I think that's what they think. They think, well, you know, we'll back off just an inch or two, and the courts are going to defer to the president. They're not going to tell the president no twice. That's what I think is going on here politically.
What do you think the response should be from people who are rightly outraged at Trump's rhetoric during the campaign, where he talked about banning Muslims blatantly? And of course, that first executive order put that campaign rhetoric into action. Now, this may be a little diluted, a little more subtle, but the objectives, according to a lot of people who are looking at this new executive order, I think it's really the same thing in new packaging. What do you think the response should be from civil society to this thing?
Well, I think that's very true. And I think people should not be giving an inch. They should say, well, it was wrong before, and this slightly tweaked version is also wrong, but should also have some confidence that we can win or that we are winning. So I just happened to scan a few colleague organizations to see what their statements were today, as well as our organizational statement about this. And the four or five that I checked out are all still condemning this Muslim ban 2.0. But one, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the one thing that they did put in it was that folks who had resisted the first version of it should feel confident that this was a bit of a victory, not necessarily substantively, because they only changed a few things. They dropped Iraq from the seven countries. It's now six. It won't affect permanent green card holders. They say it's only going to be temporary for 120 days, which is what the other one said too, but it's clear, at least for some of the countries, they're going to try to make it permanent. So substantively, wasn't that much different. But again, CARE was saying that people that resisted the first one should feel that this is a bit of a victory politically, that the administration had to back off a little bit. But they're not at all advocating that people be quiet about it. They're still advocating militant resistance and opposition.
One of the rationales for this Muslim ban, both during the campaign and when the first executive order was issued, was to say there's an urgency to stopping travel from certain countries because they pose a dire threat to the United States. Now, all that seemed to be laughable from the fact that when the federal court that actually struck down this initial travel ban asked the Trump administration to produce evidence to back up their claim that this was urgent for national security, they could not produce anything. And now, of course, this new travel ban, 2.0, looks to be a gradual kind of weeks-long implementation and doesn't seem at all urgent.
Well, that's very true, but it's also they've had to deal with contradictions, fact-based contradictions, which, of course, they don't like very much, from the government. So even the Department of Homeland Security, Trump's own, advisors now in DHS, said a recent report that a person's country of citizenship is unlikely to be a reliable indicator of potential terrorist activity. That was a quote. And the other thing, too, is the horrible irony that four of these six countries, the United States is engaged in militarily. So we're helping to create refugees from some of these countries. It is just Orwellian. You don't have to listen to peaceniks like me. You have like hard-nosed national security experts with whom I would not agree about a lot of things saying not only is this not going to achieve what the purported reason for it is, it's going to make America less safe. This is feeding into radical extremist groups thinking that the United States hates Muslims. ISIS has called this the blessed ban. So that tells you a lot right there in terms of the counter productivity of this. And it really has nothing to do with making Americans safer. It's part of this very fearful, racist xenophobia that I don't want our country, our society to be known for.
That was Kevin Martin, president of Peace Action. Find more analysis and commentary on Trump's revised travel ban by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Of the many disturbing questions hanging over the presidency of Donald Trump, perhaps the most potentially serious is the yet unknown connections between Trump, officials in his campaign, and billionaire oligarchs linked to the Russian government. Trump's consistently uncritical views of Russian President Vladimir Putin stand in stark contrast to the bipartisan enmity expressed toward Moscow that's been prevalent in Washington in most of the years since the end of the Cold War. With U.S. intelligence agencies concluding that Moscow had hacked America's 2016 presidential election in an attempt to damage Hillary Clinton's campaign and boost Trump, repeated statements by the president and other White House staff that they had no contact with Russian officials have proven false. Through press reports, it's been revealed that senior Trump associates had met or spoken with Russia's U.S. Ambassador Sergei Kislyak during the campaign, including Trump himself, Trump's senior aide Jared Kushner, ousted National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, advisors J.D. Gordon, Carter Page, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who had denied any meetings under oath during his Senate confirmation hearing. But parallel investigations have revealed another set of Trump-Russian relationships linked to the real estate billionaire's financial investments. Your reporter spoke with James S. Henry, a senior fellow at Columbia University's Center for Sustainable International Investment and Global Justice Fellow at Yale University, who discusses the connections he's uncovered between Trump, Russian oligarch Dmitry Rebolovlev, the Bank of Cyprus, and newly confirmed Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross.
Well, I come to this story with a strong interest in offshore banking, and Cyprus has for over a decade been the principal conduit of what's called round tripping. It's where Russian investors, to protect their assets, they take and book their investments into Russia by way of Cyprus companies or trusts. And they also use Cyprus banks because Cyprus is a member of the EU since 2004. It uses the euro currency since 2008. And so there's a lot of Russian money that's been flowing through Cyprus banks. In 2013, this came to a head because the Cyprus banking system basically collapsed. There had been so much funny money coming out of Russia into Cyprus, and they had invested this in things like Greek bonds and in all kinds of dubious real estate projects, that the banking system was something like 12 times GDP in terms of total exposure, total debt. And the banking system collapsed. At that point, it came to light that the largest bank in Cyprus was basically filled to the rim with Russian deposits, and they compensated the Russian shareholders who lost their deposits in the banking crisis by giving them shares in the bank. So the Bank of Cyprus basically became majority Russian-owned. But they needed someone to kind of turn this situation around for the bank, and Wilbur Ross is an American investor who's had some people call him a vulture capitalist. Some of them call him the turnaround king. In any case, he came in with a group of U.S. and European investors and invested enough to acquire 17% of the shares of the Bank of Cyprus. You know, nothing wrong with that, except that what you're doing basically is turning around a bank that intrinsically is only kind of business plan is to launder money for Russians. And half of its shareholders at that point, and still are probably at least a third of the shares of the bank are owned by Russian investors, and including some very well-known oligarchs. The largest investor to this day in the Bank of Cyprus is a fellow named Viktor Vekselberg, who is basically the aluminum czar. He owns quite a few companies, but his dominant position is in the aluminum industry. By any stretch of the imagination, he is a GARC, and he owns 9.3% of the Bank of Cyprus. The other two investors, one was at the time Ross invested, and for the next year and a half, was a former KGB agent appointed to his position by Putin. Vekselberg and this fellow, who was vice chairman of the bank with Ross, were both appointed by Putin, in fact, to those positions. And the third fellow is a guy who had bought Donald Trump's house in Florida in 2008, a fellow named Ribolovlev, who was the potash czar at that time of Russia. So here you have all these various Russian interests, you know, sort of crowded into this bank. The bank also had a tremendous reputation and to this day seems to be engaged in money laundering. So, you know, and who did he bring in? Ross personally brought in to run the bank the former head of Deutsche Bank, Joseph Ackermann, who had presided over a period of profound impropriety at Deutsche Bank, which Deutsche Bank is really struggling still to this day. I think they just announced an effort to raise capital this week. But their latest fine was for laundering $10 billion of Russian dirty money through New York and Cyprus, for which they got a $650 million fine in January. So bringing in this particular guy to run the Bank of Cyprus sort of raised questions, particularly since Deutsche Bank is the one global bank that loaned money to Donald Trump and is still his largest creditor. So what I've concluded from all this is that, you know, we don't have a smoking gun. There's nothing necessarily illegal. We should be cautious about drawing any firm conclusions about this stuff. But I also did an article for the American Interest in December, which pointed out Trump's extensive connections with lots of folks who are basically, you know, sort of very close to the Russian mafia. So it isn't just a question of, you know, Putin and the spying that the 17 intelligence agencies concluded constituted interference in the U.S. election. This involves private connections and money flowing out of Russia, round-tripped back into Russia, or being invested in Trump's projects. Stuff that really, you know, I think deserves to be investigated by Congress or by a commission.
That was James S. Henry, a longtime investigator of corrupt international banking and illegal tax havens, who serves as a senior advisor to the Tax Justice Network. Find links to Henry's recent articles on Trump-Russia connections by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In his first week in office, Donald Trump issued executive orders to expedite construction of the Keystone XL pipeline and the Dakota Access Pipeline. When President Obama halted the project, the Dakota Pipeline was almost finished, and now with a green light from the Trump administration, is nearing completion of the last section under the Missouri River. Construction of the Keystone XL Pipeline has not yet begun. After years of grassroots organizing along the pipeline route in and around the country, in November 2015, President Obama denied a key permit for the project to cross from Canada into the U.S. After taking office, Trump invited TransCanada, the company that wants to build the Keystone Pipeline, to reapply for a permit. The company did so, proposing the same route that was denied by Obama. Now the project application is back before the State Department, led by former ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson, a company that is heavily involved in tar sands development in Alberta that would feed the Keystone Pipeline. A decision on the application is expected in the next few months. If built, the pipeline would run from Alberta, Canada, through Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska, where it would connect to an existing pipeline to deliver 830,000 barrels a day of the dirtiest form of oil on the planet to refineries on the U.S. Gulf Coast. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Linda Anderson, director of Bold Nebraska, one of the groups that led opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline in the past, with creative grassroots strategies that united ranchers and farmers and worked with indigenous opponents of the project. Here, Anderson observes that with a new oil industry-friendly Trump administration, her group has had to change their tactics.
There was a lot of pressure on Obama to kind of end the fight on that pipeline. Us, including a large coalition of people, environmentalists, people who are against eminent domain for private gain, a huge group of people, natives, you know, they all were putting a lot of pressure. And I think the pressure just became a little more insurmountable because it was just building up and building up and building up. I mean, we are going to put pressure on Trump, but more so on the Nebraska Public Service Commission and legislators, senators, and people like that. Before, we had sort of an ally in Obama, sort of how we saw it. And this time around, we don't really have an ally in the White House. You know, we've never actually gone through the Public Service Commission process before because the last time TransCanada filed, but then they immediately tried to get eminent domain, which is illegal. So we immediately went to court to stop them from trying to do that. This time, they're sort of playing by the rules, which means that we have to go through the Public Service Commission process. So it's looking different for everybody.
What's the role of the Public Service Commission in Nebraska?
TransCanada has to file an application through the Public Service Commission. So the Public Service Commission has to either approve or deny the application. So it's really up to them on whether or not this pipeline goes through.
Do you think you have any allies there?
We know for sure that we have at least one ally, but as far as the other four, we kind of, because there's five people on the Public Service Commission, we have to kind of figure out where they're at and appeal to them and their sensibility. You know, Nebraska is a very conservative state, and we have a lot of libertarians in this state, and they love free market, as you know. So we sort of have to convince libertarians or people that lean that way that this is eminent domain for private gain, and that's not a good thing. That's not good for the general public. There's people that we can convince on an environmental basis.
Linda Anderson, I understand you're at the state capitol right now at a hearing to put a moratorium on wind turbines in the Sand Hills region. Is there any connection to the Keystone XL project?
No, it's a totally separate issue. It's actually a Republican senator that's proposing this bill to put a moratorium on wind energy. And it's really interesting. There's a lot of Republicans that are on the committee that's hearing this bill today, and they keep talking about the fragile grounds of the Sand Hills, and it's fascinating to all of a sudden hear them care. Because before, you know, if you ask them any other time, if we're talking about, you know, oil pipelines, it doesn't seem like they care. But with wind energy, they all of a sudden care about the ecosystem there. Bold Nebraska is taking a neutral stance on that simply because we feel that they should not just put a moratorium on wind energy in the Sandhills, but they should also put one, a moratorium on any projects in the Sandhills, because it is a very fragile ecosystem that would end up affecting the aquifer. It would affect the ground. It would affect the animals and wildlife.
Is Bold Nebraska opposed to the Keystone XL no matter what, or would you be fine with it if it didn't run through Nebraska?
We're opposed to pipelines in general. Bold Nebraska is an arm of a larger entity called Bold Alliance, and we're actually fighting pipelines in several different states. We firmly believe that it's now time, in fact, it's past time, to move to clean energy. And, you know, it's interesting, we're at this bill with the wind energy, you know, LB 504, where they're opposing wind energy, and we're at a neutral stance because we do care about the Sandhills. However, we are proponents of wind energy in other circumstances, and we're huge proponents of solar. Like I said, it's time to move on from fossil fuels.
Are you thinking of reconstituting the coalition you had fighting the Keystone XL, like the Cowboy Indian Alliance, Ranchers and Farmers, and national environmental groups like 350?
Yep, we are working on bringing all of those groups back together and more, because obviously since we've had a regime change, there's been a lot more groups that have come about, more progressive-oriented groups, so we'll bring them in and work with as many groups as possible in the intervening process so that we can make sure the Public Service Commission knows that Nebraskans are against this pipeline.
That was Linda Anderson, director of the group Bold Nebraska. Learn more about continuing opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline project, including a map of the proposed pipeline route, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.